Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show, broadcasting live from the fabulously fluoridated capital of Auckland, New Zealand, the island-chained nation in the sunny slave South Pacific. It's so gorgeous down here. It's even Fukushima irradiated, which is good for the economy because everybody managed to snap up a part-time job as an incandescent light bulb. Now, today, my very special guest, who's just joining us now for the full 2 hours today, because we're going to have a lot to talk about New Zealand media, is Paul Carruthers. Welcome to the show, my friend.
Thanks, Vinny. How are you doing?
Yeah, somewhat fabulous is kind of the standard response that I give out.
I'm not quite sure I can say that today, but that's okay.
What is it to be say fabulous?
You might have got me a couple of weekends ago at the Pride Festival saying that, but not today, mate.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Well, what's on the agenda for today, man?
Let's talk about Alan Hubbard. Let's talk about... I want to talk about the media's role in what happened to him, and also to give you some more information that's come to light in the last more than a year since he died, that those of us who are involved with him are aware of, and just to let your listeners get an idea of what's been going on behind the scenes in New Zealand. So let's talk about all of that, shall we?
All right. Can I just preface this for the listeners? Those of you who don't know who Alan Hubbard is, he was a guy who was running this massive finance company called South Canterbury Finance. Good Christian man, you know, the kind of person who does a deal on a handshake and doesn't go back on it, you know, not nice, lovely guy, not living extravagantly, driving around in a very small car, living in the same home for like 30, 40 years or whatever, just a couple of bedrooms, and the only modern piece of equipment that he had was something for his kidney dialysis, that kind of thing. And then the Serious Fraud Office, which runs a whole lot of serious fraud in this country, as is most government agencies, that they basically do the direct opposite of what they're stated intention is, stole Canterbury Finance, and as a direct result, all of these farmers and many other people lost their money, not as a result of incompetence of the company, but as a result of the government stealing it, because it was one of the only solvent companies involving finance left in the country. Is that about a quick summary of it?
I've got my own take on it. It's very similar to what you said. I mean, you've pretty much covered the main issues. The real issue here is that, the way I see it, is that 62 finance companies collapsed under the previous Labor government's watch prior to 2008. So between 2004-ish and 2008, you had 62 finance companies in New Zealand collapsed, at costing a lot of investors, a lot of elderly retired people, more than $8.5 billion of life savings, right? So by the time Labor lost the election in 2008 and John Key came in, you had a lot of angry people in New Zealand, very angry people, though. I don't think it's the only reason why Labor was voted out in 2008, but I think it was one of the significant contributing factors, was that crap loads of New Zealanders, hardworking New Zealanders, had lost their life savings in finance company collapses. And here's the thing. In unregulated finance company collapses, now this is where the Labor government or the regulators, the Ministry of Economic Development and the Companies Office and all these people who are supposed to oversee all of the regulation of finance companies and their proper functioning and to make sure that the directors are acting ethically, do their proper random checks on them, also just wasn't happening. So they received a lot of criticism for it, even from the media. So here you've got a lot of people. Here you had the situation. It was quite combustible because you had a lot of high-profile people in the media had staked their reputations on having a go at the Labor government about their non-involvement or their complete lack of regulatory oversight of these finance company directors, allowing these companies just sort of fold like decks of like a house of cards. So you had a combination of more than 500,000 very angry people in New Zealand and people who were indirectly affected by the finance company collapses too, who didn't necessarily lose their life savings, but businesses collapsed in, you know, that were related to it, and it caused a lot of unemployment. And so there was a lot of people who pretty much hated finance companies and hated finance company directors by the time 2008 came around and John Key got elected. So here you had a very combustible situation where Labor had just been kicked out. Everybody was pissed off with them because they hadn't regulated finance company collapses. They hadn't regulated the finance companies at all. They'd received a lot of criticism for it. John Key was the new bright-eyed boy in town. And here's the thing. The historical evidence shows that on the first day in office, Bill English was given the choice as to whether to extend the Crown guarantee of South Canterbury Finance. That's the government's taxpayer-funded sort of guarantee scheme of the finance companies, which you remember the Americans put that into place with their financial system, the British did it, everyone in the Western world did it. So the Labor backed South Canterbury Finance in the Crown guarantee, and Bill English was given the choice on his first day in the job as to whether to roll that agreement over and continue the thing. Now, he was advised at that point, and an Official Information Act request can show you the email to this effect, that he was advised not to do that. He was advised by Bollard himself, the head of the Reserve Bank, not to continue the Crown guarantee on South Henry Finance. Bollard actually said, Alan Hubbard's a good man. In the email, he said to Bill English, Alan Hubbard, well, he said to Treasury, Alan Hubbard's a good man. He's been doing this for 60 years. If he can't make it work, nobody can. There's no need for the government to be backing this. This company can stand on its own two feet. And here's the important thing. It's not critical to the New Zealand economy if it fails, right? English ignored that advice and continued with the and reapplied the Crown guarantee on his first or second day in the job. Now, this effectively gave John Key the license to do pretty much what he liked with this finance company by, you know, by using the fact that the leverage John Key had was the fact that taxpayer money was guaranteeing it, right? So you had this situation where John Key knew he had a lot of angry people who had just voted Labor out, who'd lost all their life savings. They wanted someone to hang for finance company collapses, anyone. These people didn't care who it was. They didn't care if it was Eric Watson or Mark Hotchin. They didn't care. They just wanted someone to go down. Right? So in many respects, Alan Hubbard was the perfect person for John Key to point the finger at. Now, my gripe and the reason why I got involved in this right from day one always has been that the failure of process that occurred here, the fact that this man was hung out to dry on the basis of accusations made by the Prime Minister and other key people, without any court orders, without any court oversight, without any court direction whatsoever.
Or any evidence.
Exactly, or any evidence. So here you've got, you know, we've had this more than 2 years down the track, this massive media trial that erupted around this man, and he was found guilty in the court of public opinion, all over Facebook, all over the newspapers. I mean, I can remember journalists ringing me up angrily demanding to know why I was defending this man's rights. And the day he was charged, Brent Impey, the guy that used to own TV, Radio Live, he rang me up. They put him on the job of ringing me up to interview me the day Alan Hubbard was charged. And if you actually go back and listen to that issue in the Radio Live archives, the guy was like an attack dog. And I had to point out to him that charges are not evidence of a crime. Right? That is not evidence of a crime. And a radio interview is not a courtroom. Right? It wasn't his place or my place to hang this man on the basis of the fact that the government had just charged him with crimes. And I pointed out to him, I think I remember pointing out to him, that 9 months before Alan Hubbard was even charged with a crime, John Key walked out onto the steps of Parliament and influenced public opinion on the matter by saying this exact phrase, Alan Hubbard was completely responsible for bankrupting that company. Now, that happened on the night that South Canterbury Finance was put into receivership, while Alan Hubbard was still under investigation, almost 10 months before he was even charged with a crime. So here you have a situation in New Zealand where the Prime Minister is actually, if somebody wants to go to the TVNZ archives, I think it's around about the 30th of September or around that date of 2010. You've got the Prime Minister on public record in the TVNZ archives influencing the public opinion on a matter that in every other time he has been asked to produce the evidence to support what he said about Alan Hubbard, or any of his officials have been asked to produce the evidence, they have resorted to the standard line of the matter is before the courts, I can't comment. And yet on this instance, every time it suited them, every time the statutory managers they appointed to Alan Hubbard to manage his affairs and all the rest of it produced a report to damning him or discrediting him, it was given to the media before it was even given to Alan Hubbard or his lawyers or their investors.
Now, it seems like a wholesale, it seems like using political clout in order to influence the public so that somebody can get away with a massive heist, essentially.
Absolutely.
I've seen this happen to a number of prominent New Zealand businessmen who have come up with really big deals, like the Chris Wardell case, who had a multi-million dollar property investment track, and yet his bank that was going to be going in partnership and business with him actually stole his deal, and as a direct result of him trying to expose the fact that they stole his deal, he got raided by the police and a whole bunch of other political rigmarole and things like that came down on him. So what happens in this country is if you're not part of the gang comes down on you, particularly if you're highly successful.
This is what we watched happen. We absolutely watched exactly that happen to Alan Hubbard. And it was interesting to see the personalities that waded into the fray to stick it to this man. It was quite concerning. And I've got some observations to make about that as well. But going back to it, what you have here is the situation where the Prime Minister... Look, historically, if you do the timeline, and I have, because I've got thousands of pages on this issue. I know it intimately well. I spoke to Alan Hubbard for hours and hours every week on the telephone and in person for the last 15 months of his life. We became good friends. I know his side of the story. I even know the documentation that was going to be put into the courtroom in his defence 3 days after he was killed. And that includes information that's never been released to the public that Alan gave to me over the telephone, that he told me over the telephone that his lawyers were going to put in the courtroom. Now, the thing is that what you have is a situation where the head of the company's office, Neville Harris, right, I can show you evidence of speeches that he was giving as far back as 2009, long before they even stuck it to Alan Hubbard, where he was standing up in seminars and things like that, giving speeches about finance company collapses and saying that someone out there in New Zealand was running a Ponzi scheme and that they were that it was only a matter of time before they found one. And he was sort of... It was very evident to anyone who knew, who'd been watching what had been going on for the previous few years, that this was Neville Harris basically standing up trying to justify the fact that he hadn't done anything, that all these finance company collapses had occurred on his watch and no people had received any protection. So there he was sort of up on a stage pontificating as early as 2000 or as late in some people's opinion as 2009, sort of saying, oh, you know, we're going to stick it to a finance company, just you wait, we'll get one of these people sooner or later, one of these people's running a Ponzi scheme. I find it interesting that then less than a year later, after giving those kind of speeches and saying that this is what the outcome was going to be, suddenly this big case erupts in the case of Alan Hubbard, and lo and behold, it's all about a Ponzi scheme, right?
What I also find very ironic is that another finance company, Hewlett Wealth Management, which was actually shown to have fraudulently supplied prospectuses to...
Hewlett was done over in the courts by it.
Yeah, and the other two people who signed off on those things as well as Hewlett was the Honourable John Banks and the Honourable Don Brash.
That's right. So
exactly. Who had no consequences of any kind. And so it's the point that I made before. If you're not part of the gang, you go down.
Exactly. And it goes further than that. Let's go back to, let's have a look at, let's talk about Rugby World Cup. What's his name? Leukemia. Jock Hobbs. Okay? Now, this is one of those situations where it gets really messy because the love affair with rugby in New Zealand is so big that you can't do this stuff without upsetting or offending somebody. But let's forget the emotional side of it. Let's just deal with the facts. The facts are that this man was running a finance company, the other directors of which are currently before the courts. Right? So Jock Hobbs was a director of a finance company that where the case was investigated, wrongdoing has been found, apparently. The other directors are now before the courts, but they kept the case at bay and kept it all quiet until now, after everything's sort of blown over, and Jock Hobbs was completely... The FMA, the Financial Markets Authority, actually said we won't do anything to Jock Hobbs because, well, he's got leukemia and he's, you know, not very well and all the rest of it. Well, okay, so he was 54 and he had leukemia, and he was also a really big ex-All Black. So there's all these reasons why they wouldn't touch Jock Hobbs, and they actually openly stated that that's why they weren't doing anything to him, because they felt sorry for him. And yet Alan Hubbard was 83 years old. He was 30 years older
on kidney
dialysis treatment three times a week. But those rules went out the window when it was Alan Hubbard's case. So what I'm saying is the double standards in this situation are alarming and disturbing, and I'm really, really surprised that more New Zealanders didn't kick up a stink about it.
Well, I found it very, very hilarious that a man named Jock was a sportsman. We'll be right back after the break at the VinnieEastwoodShow.com, ladies and gentlemen. My very special guest is Paul Carruthers. Back in just a few minutes. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. Boogieing it down in Russian underground. It's the Vinnie Eastwood Show on AmericanFreedomRadio.com. 5 days a week, you can tune into this radio program. And if you are not tuning in live, you can listen to the archive by a terrorist organization called Archiva. My very special guest is Paul Carruthers, coming out live from a wonderful-looking, spiffy, fluorescent office in Auckland. Welcome back.
I think I can do a better Russian accent than you, Vinny.
You put me to shame.
Hey, getting back to the Alan Hubbard situation, mate, so in the South Canterbury Finance, I just want to go back over the timeline so we bring everybody forward at the same thing. What you had was the regulators didn't act. Labor got voted out partly because of it. One of the chief regulators, the head of the company's office, a year before they even stuck it to Alan Hubbard, was up there on the stage sort of flag-waving and going on about how he was, you know, not acknowledging that he hadn't done anything up until this point, but that he was just sort of reassuring everybody that they were gonna do something to somebody with the finance company, you know, they were going to act, don't worry, type of thing. And he was convinced there was a Ponzi scheme. And lo and behold, a year later, the government discovers this big thing that hit the headlines as guess what? A Ponzi scheme, right? So if you remember the rhetoric and the headlines when they first launched all this thing about Alan Hubbard, it was all a Ponzi scheme, and he was being compared to Bernie Madoff and all this sort of thing. I can actually show you a photograph of John Key standing up in Parliament with a piece of paper in his hands, and I had that photo blown up by an expert, and you can actually see handwriting on the page. And on that page are very clearly written the words Bernie Madoff and Ponzi scheme. Now, that's a Fairfax photograph. I've written to Fairfax and asked them when that photograph was taken. They've never replied to me. But that photograph, you can find it on the internet. And if you actually have it blown up, you can clearly see John Key standing there with a piece of paper. Now, why is John Key waving a bit of paper around in New Zealand Parliament with the words Bernie Madoff and Ponzi scheme written on it?
Maybe it's his idol?
I don't know. But, you know, there's all these little indicators that you sort of... That plus all the Official Information Act requests we did after Alan was put into statutory management and accused of fraud, that proved beyond any doubt, I would defy any of our critics or any of Alan Hubbard's critics to suggest that this man was not set up, because if they dare to do it, I will produce the evidence to show that they are wrong. And it is not my opinion. I can produce emails from Treasury. I can produce internal government emails that have been obtained as a part of Official Information Act requests. I can produce reports from investigations that have been done that prove beyond any doubt that this man was absolutely, systematically and deliberately set up by the government to be portrayed as a fraud before the accusations were even made. So this whole case against this guy did not happen randomly, right, as a result of officials doing their job. It was carefully orchestrated and constructed, and the planning for it was being done over a year before they actually started taking action against him. So what you have is a situation where John Key effectively pushed the taxpayers and the investors off the side of the good ship Hubbard to create the appearance that everybody needed rescuing. And that is exactly what's happened here. So by pointing the finger at Alan Hubbard and saying that he hadn't captained the ship properly, that he'd driven the ship onto the iceberg, that everybody needed the government to step in and rescue them from this hideous, heinous, fraudulent man, Alan Hubbard. Right? And that's how this whole thing was set up. And the public was so angry by that stage with finance company directors in general, they didn't care who John Key pointed the finger at. He could have pointed the finger at a bloody Teletubby and they would have got angry about it. You see what I'm saying?
Big scam!
Absolutely. And the thing is that, so what we had is that, remember the last interview I did with you, I got very angry about the subject because I said, I was trying to say to the New Zealand public, a man has been found guilty here without a trial because someone with a bigger public profile pointed the finger at him. And you cannot have that in a civil society.
Here's the litmus test. Here's the litmus test. How do you know you're living under a tyranny? There's one rule for the rulers and one rule for the rulers.
Exactly, exactly. And I'm angry. I'm not angry anymore. I'm disappointed and sad that the New Zealand public let that happen. But I'll tell you why I defended it. I defended it because everyone is entitled to the presumption of innocence. You, me, and everyone else. Everyone watching this, if you're watching me right now, you are entitled to the presumption of innocence before being proven guilty in a proper court of law before a jury of your peers. Now, understand this. The reason why I defended Alan Hubbard's rights so vigorously, and he could have been Bob Smith or anyone else for all matters, I defended his rights because he was denied that fundamental right. Okay? To this day, not one court order exists to justify any of the actions the government took against that man. Not one. There is not one court order. No judicial oversight was sought. This was an executive decision made by an MP, by a Minister of Parliament alone. And to this day, there is still not a court order in place to justify the seizure and the sale of Alan Hubbard's assets. Now, a convicted drug dealer gets more protection than Alan Hubbard was given in that situation.
Well, that's convenient because I'm a convicted drug dealer.
I don't know. But what I do know is this, Vinny. If that's the case, the police would have had to obtain a court order to have the right to seize your assets and sell them. And that in that sense, you are entitled to and you would receive more protection than Alan Hubbard was given. So in this particular case, this man's rights were completely trampled and dispensed with, and it has been allowed to happen for two reasons. One, because the man who issued the accusations against him is so powerful that nobody knows how to stand up to him, and nobody will stand up to him. And secondly, because the cult of personality is so strong that all these people, he was playing people. John Key was playing people. He was tapping in, he was pushing the buttons of all of those angry people that wanted a finance company director to go down, and they didn't care who it was, right? And John Key played those people beautifully, and they fell for it. Hook, line and sinker, like lemmings off the cliff, right? Now, you know, though it's not getting angry with Alan Hubbard is not going to bring those people's money back. That's what alarmed me about the whole thing, about the way these people all carried on, the Brent Timpies of this world and all the journalists that sort of went, hang this man, we don't care if he gets a trial or not, just hang him. I'm like, how is this going to help any of you people? How is this going to bring the money back? How is this going to protect future investors? How does this draw attention, what you're doing, how does this draw attention to the complete failure of the regulators to act until now and the fact that they're completely overreacting now and going after the wrong guy in a really messy case that they've constructed, which amounts to a complete travesty of justice? They went after, and yet 2 years down the track, Hotchin and Watchin are still off scot-free. They haven't been charged with anything yet. How does that happen?
Hotchin and Watchin, are they like the sworn enemies of Hansel and Gretel?
Who knows? But at the end of the day, the point is, those two men are still wandering around free, and everybody's playing touchy-feely about how much to accuse these guys of and what they can get away with saying about them. And I'll tell you the reason why. Because they know that Hotchin will sue them from here to kingdom come if they try it. That's why all the commentators are a lot more careful what they say about Mark Hotchin or Eric Watson than they ever did about Alan Hubbard.
It's a Hotchin Hubbard. In other words, it's a Hotchin potato.
Drop the Hotchin potato. The point is, mate, the double standards, as we've said before, the double standards in the situation are alarming. And I'm gobsmacked that the majority of New Zealanders didn't get this. I'll give you an example of how financially illiterate New Zealanders are and how they're being had, just completely and utterly done over. A little example of how people are just, their own foolishness costs them, right? Bridgecorp investors, the day Petricevich was given 6 years in jail. Now, I was listening to Radio Live that day, and it was just sad listening to all these people. They gave one old guy, this Australian guy, an old elderly investor who'd really been done, they gave him a lot of television time and a lot of air time, that particular man. He really stuck it to Petricevich. Oh, you know, he should have got 10 years. And that was the general sort of theme on the day, was that the Petricevich got off lightly, should have got 10 years. So all these angry people having a go, right? Now, here's this. I rang Radio Live, and I got a lot of support for what I said. I said, none of this carry-on is actually helping investors in any way at all. A, because it won't bring your money back, and B, because it doesn't address the real issue. The real issue is all of this money was lost on the regulator's watch, and they did nothing to stop it from happening. Why aren't you going after them? Why is the head of the company's office getting off scot-free here? Why are all these people who should have been doing their jobs getting away with not having done their jobs?
Mm.
Do you understand what I'm saying?
What I found strange is that the reason the Serious Fraud Office stated that they started to investigate South Canterbury Finance is because somebody laid a complaint that they had not received a prospectus from South Canterbury Finance, who does not give out prospectuses.
No, South Canterbury Finance had to have a prospectus because they were a publicly listed finance company, and they were part of the Crown Guarantee, and they had public investors, and they advertised for investors. The thing is the anonymous complaint that was made about Alan Hubbard was actually made in relation to one of his private finance companies called Aorangi. Now, Aorangi didn't legally need to produce a prospectus because he never advertised for investors. People rocked his door, knocked on his door and said, we want to give you our money. He never advertised once. So there was no legal requirement under the Securities Act for him to produce a prospectus. Now, they moved in on him. And the excuse they used was that he hadn't produced a prospectus, but here's the thing, it was unlawful for them to demand that he did. And it still is to this day. There never was a requirement for Alan Hubbard to produce a prospectus for Aorangi because he never advertised for investors. People gave him their money willingly, right? And, you know, so all of these actions that have been taken against this man were completely flawed and unlawful right from the start. This whole beat-up was they used two of his private finance companies that had nothing to do with South Canterbury Finance. They called him fraudulent in relation to those two finance companies, and they used that as an excuse to foreclose on him. And then they made it after that fact, once they'd started foreclosing on him, then they made it about South Canterbury Finance. But they, if you actually, I can go back and prove this to you beyond any doubt with documented evidence and newspaper articles, that what they did was they did a bait and switch. They put him into statutory management and accused him of fraud in relation to Aorangi Finance and Hubbard Managed Funds. But they said right from the start, even the head of the Securities Commission, right from the start, 6 weeks before South Canterbury Finance was even put into receivership, was on record as saying, this has got nothing to do with South Canterbury Finance. We're taking these actions against Alan Hubbard because of his private finance companies. It's got nothing to do with South Canterbury Finance. Because when we went to the government, right back at the beginning, if you remember, I did the complaint to the Ombudsman, I said, the guy that made the decision in the government to put Alan in this situation, based on this anonymous report, on this anonymous letter, has a conflict of interest. And the conflict of interest that his own brother was bankrupted by South Canterbury Finance a year before for $8 million. And I said, this is a conflict of interest. Now, at that point, I can pull out a newspaper article anytime you like to any of my critics and show them where the head of the Securities Commission at the time, Jane Diplock, came out in response to what I said and said the actions we are taking about against Alan Hubbard have nothing to do with South Canterbury Finance. This is to do. So in other words, what she tried to do was to say, oh, yes, well, we know the Securities Commission member who made the decision to put Alan in this situation did have his brother, but his brother was bankrupted by South Canterbury Finance a year ago. So we understand that that would look like a conflict of interest, but we want everybody to understand that these actions we're taking against Alan Hubbard now have nothing to do with South Canterbury Finance. And yet 6 weeks later, there's John Key on national television going, Alan Hubbard completely bankrupted that company. Now, those were the exact words he used. So we have the situation where the Prime Minister himself is involved in a bait and switch where the government 6 weeks earlier was trying to convince the New Zealand public that the actions they were taking against Alan Hubbard had nothing to do with South Canterbury Finance. They are on the record in the newspapers as saying that, and then it completely changed 6 weeks later, and it was all Alan Hubbard's fault, according to John Key on national television. So listen up, New Zealanders. The evidence you want is there. It's in the TVNZ archives. John Key is on record influencing public opinion, prejudicing public opinion against a man who was still under investigation. And every time John Key has been asked to produce the proof to support what he's saying, he immediately defaults and resorts to, oh, well, the matter's before the court, so I can't say.
You know, it's very interesting. I would like to see whether or not John Key is connected with any of the people that actually got the receivership and took any of the resources and assets and things of that nature from the company itself, and whether or not he actually personally financially benefited from this case in and of itself. Unfortunately, we're coming to break. We'll be right back. Paul Carruthers, ladies and gentlemen.
The word is about, there's something evolving. Whatever may come, the world keeps revolving. They say the next big thing is here, that the revolution's near. But to me it seems quite clear that it's all just a little bit of history repeating.
Welcome back. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show. It's the lighter side of genocide, because in a world so full of chaos and madness and scumbaggery, if you lose your sense of humour, you'll go friggin' nuts. A very special guest is Paul Carruthers. And Paul, I was wondering if you'd be able to elucidate on my questions there before the break about whether or not John Key's connected with any of these receivers in some way, because I know that he's got a lot of blind trusts, and I know that he knows what's in those blind trusts.
What people in New Zealand, I think what's happened here is that there's a lot of things that have happened in the last few years since he became elected where people, they appear to be independent, these situations, from each other, but I see some connections. And I tell you, one of the things that really disturbs me, there's one thing that's happened in particular that I think is quite alarming. And just the facts alone, this is not my opinion, these are factual. You can go and research anything I'm saying here, and you can take you 2 or 3 minutes of Googling to find the information I'm talking about, and it will prove it to you beyond any reasonable doubt. We have a situation in New Zealand where, since this government was elected in 2008, we had a situation where the Crayford Farms issue blew up. And I'll tell you how that blew up. It blew up because of the actions of one journalist. And that journalist is a guy in Auckland by the name of Bernard Hickey. He lives in Herne Bay, runs a website called interest.co.nz. He's on TV all the time. They use him as a go-to guy for, you know, like an economic spokesperson. I think his brother's a weather presenter, right, on TV, or used to be. Now, Bernard Hickey, interestingly, is one of the journalists who really stuck it to Alan Hubbard, right? He wrote a really nasty article shortly after the government put Alan Hubbard in this position, in the situation. He wrote a big, long article saying 10 reasons why Alan Hubbard should apologise to New Zealand. So yet another example of a journalist who just waded in and stuck it to this man while the matter was under investigation, long before, you know, there's no evidence, just all rhetoric and opinion, you know, sticking it to a finance company director. That I noticed Bernard Hickey would never write such a thing about Mark Hodgson or Eric Watson or any of the other guys. Why? I think these guys already knew that Alan Hubbard wasn't going to fight back. They'd already sussed his personality out. They'd already realised that he was a very forgiving person with a very specific set of beliefs that prevented him from taking a retaliatory approach, right? So, and this is the only reason, having got to know Alan very well, let me assure you, New Zealanders, look me in the eye and get this. The only reason these people got away with what they did to Alan Hubbard was because he didn't and wouldn't fight back. If Alan Hubbard had the same mentality as Kim.com, John Key would be out of a job and this government would be toast by a country mile, right? So understand that clearly. So going back to it, we've got the situation where Bernard Hickey got out of bed. Now, you can, if you Google this, you'll find it on Wikipedia. Google something like, hang on, I'll do it while we're on thing here, just to make sure I'm right.
On a side note, I have significantly more YouTube subscribers than Bernard Hickey does.
Oh, do you?
Yeah.
Okay. So Bernard Hickey, if you Google this, Bernard Hickey, Crayford Farms video, what comes up is a Wikipedia. The first site that is a Wikipedia reference to the fact that Bernard Hickey is on record. Here it is. Crayford Farms. Bernard Hickey is on record in Wikipedia as having stated that he got up in the early hours of the morning one morning. He drove to the South Waikato and he trespassed. We basically went on unannounced onto one of Alan Crayford's farms. And he went to the pig pen and he secretly filmed pigs with a video camera and he drove back to Auckland and he uploaded that video to YouTube. And within 48 hours, that had become a national issue, a national animal welfare crisis that was all over the television, that just erupted out of nowhere because Bernard Hickey uploaded this video to YouTube. Now, New Zealanders need to ask themselves this question. What possessed a journalist, an economic commentator, to drive to the middle of nowhere in the wee hours of the morning, trespass on a complete stranger's farm, film pigs, and drive back to Auckland and upload it to YouTube? What was he doing there? Who asked him to do that? What, did God visit him in a dream and ask him to do this? I mean, it's kind of... it disturbs me that this happened and nobody's asked any questions about why this happened. So
maybe.
So hear me out. So this animal welfare debate sparks up. In less than 60 days, Crayford's in receivership, right, to the Westpac Bank. They've foreclosed on him. And who's the receiver, right? Cord Amentha. Who owns Cord Amentha? Michael Stiassny. Who's Michael Stiassny? A really good friend of John Key's, right?
And he's now, he's also a corrupt person.
I'm not suggesting corruption. I'm not suggesting that there's a relation. But what I'm saying is these are the facts. Does John Key know Michael Stiassny personally? Yes. Are they? Could they be considered friends? Yes. Does Michael Stiassny own Quarter Mentha? Yes. Was Quarter Mentha appointed the receiver of Crayford Farms? Yes. Those are not my opinions. They're historical documented facts.
Could I add something supplementary here? Because Michael Stiassny has been exposed numerous times by a man named Vince Seymour, who unlawfully put one of Vince Seymour's oil companies into liquidation and things like that. If people want to learn more about that, just go to kiwisfirst.co.nz or kiwisfirst.com to learn more about the Stiassny versus Vince Seymour debacle. Very, very scary stuff there. Sorry, Paul, continue.
Anyway, so the long and the short of it is you've got this set of situations where Crayford gets put into the situation. Now, what we're talking about in Crayford's case is 16,700 hectares of prime North Island dairy land, dairy farming land. 16,700 hectares of prime North Island dairy farming land, which was delivered into the hands of the receivers in the Westpac Bank by this animal welfare debate, right, that made Crayford look really, really bad and basically buggered up the trade he was doing on the farms, and he got put into receivership in less than 2 months, right? And Quarter Mentha's appointed the receiver. Now, Quarter Mentha, owned by Michael Stiassny, John Key's friend, is the same company that was commissioned by the government to write a report about South Canterbury Finance, which has been used as the basis by all of the journalists and the government ever since to portray Alan Hubbard in a negative light. And that report specifically said that Alan Hubbard had $300 million of related party loans made to people he knew through South Canterbury Finance, which were described in the Quarter Mentha report as toxic loans. In other words, the people were not repaying. Now, understand this. When you go, if you try to go and get any information about the South Canterbury Finance receivership now from the government, they will tell you they cannot give you the information because it's a matter of commercial sensitivity. That this asset's been sold to X party or Y party and they can't tell you how much it was sold for because it's commercially sensitive, right? That the other party has the right to privacy in the transaction. Well, here's the question. If the government can put a headline in the newspaper saying Alan Hubbard cost you all $447 each of your taxpayer money to bail out this finance company that we had to bail out because he committed fraud and because he gave all these loans to people that he knew personally that aren't paying them back, right? We've had to use your money to do this, to bail this company out, and it's his fault. Remember, it's his fault. He's a fraud. Even though he's a fraud for this now as well, even though we said right at the beginning that this had nothing to do with him and that we were actually calling him a fraud about his other finance companies, but now it's sort of through a process of osmosis morphed into being fraud about South Canterbury Finance as well. You see how all these things happen? It's all happened through headlines and rhetoric. And the public's been lulled into this thing. But I can actually, again, produce the newspaper articles where the head of the Securities Commission and the government all came out screaming when I kicked up a stink about the conflict of interest right at the beginning, and they said, oh, it's got nothing to do with South Canterbury Finance. Then 6 weeks later, the Prime Minister goes out on national television and says, it's got everything to do with South Canterbury Finance. So I can show you beyond any doubt where the government did a complete flip in their approach to the situation within a six-week period, right? And now, so they've blamed Alan Hubbard, they've used taxpayer money, they've said, folks, it's going to cost you $1.5 billion of your money, and it's this man's fault, remember? No court order, no trial, just accusations from John Key and a few other people, and it's all his fault, and all of these people believe that Alan Hubbard was guilty. No trial again, no court order, none of that stuff, just accusations, right? And we've got to take their word for it. But when you try and go and get any information on the South Canterbury Finance receivership, they go, oh, no, well, you know, it's a matter of commercial sensitivity. We can't give you. Well, if they're able to use taxpayer money, my money and your money, to bail this out, and they're able to get away with calling a man who's never had a trial responsible for the whole thing, right? How do we get proof that what they're saying was correct? If every time we try and get information about it, to get them to, we second guess them on it, get them to prove what they're saying is correct, we're not allowed to have it. We're not allowed to have the information. How does that occur when it's taxpayer money? How can it be commercially sensitive when it's taxpayer money?
Yeah, and it's strange, you know. $477 a New Zealander. It's not even enough to pay the fine if you don't fill out the census.
Mate, it gets worse because initially the quarter meant to report. Michael Stastny's report said $300 million worth of loans that are a bit dodgy. We can't actually prove that. We've only got Michael Stiastny's word for it. But now they're saying it's $900 million, which has happened on their watch, but it's still Alan Hubbard's fault, but he never had a trial. Do you see the dilemmas here?
I see the dilemmas, and I always wonder when there's a dilemma, a conflict of interest, or a breach of standard operating procedure, who's behind it and who's benefiting behind the scenes as well. We'll be right back after the break with Paul Carruthers. All right, welcome back. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to hour number two of the Vinnie Eastwood Show. Paul's typing away furiously there.
Yeah, I'm actually just writing something about Alan Hubbard. Mate, so the thing with Michael Stiastny, getting back to it, because we were covering this before, right? The thing with this whole quarter-meter thing is that what I was trying to say to people is this. Understand this, New Zealanders. This has happened right in front of your eyes, and you didn't get it, right? Bernard Hickey sparked this whole bloody thing against Alan Hubbard, against Alan Crafer, and that resulted in Quarter Mentha being appointed to Crafer Farms as receiver and the sale of Crafer Farms to the Chinese. But that's not the point. The point is, somehow in that transaction, Land Corp / the government / the Crown ended up in control of this land, in control of these farms. It became the government's decision, Land Corp's decision, whether or not to sell to the Chinese. It became a government decision. Right, it was official. The OIA, the OIO, or whatever they call it, the Overseas Investment Office, or whatever, had a part to play in it all. So, all of a sudden, this was a privately owned farm where the debt was owed to the Westpac Bank, and the receiver was Michael Stiastny and Quarter Mentha. All of a sudden, it becomes a sort of a quasi Crown issue where the Crown's in control of this whole situation, working with the receivers to sell these farms. On what? On behalf of Westpac Bank to the Chinese? I don't really know. How did that actually happen? It's a bit unclear, isn't it, really? But that's not the point. The point is, you've got these commonalities where Bernard Hickey stuck it to Alan Crafer. And I mean, hello, getting up at 4 o'clock in the morning or 5 o'clock in the morning and driving to the South Waikato and sneaking onto this guy's farms and filming his pigs and coming back and sparking an animal welfare debate. If that isn't sticking it to somebody, what is? You know? I mean, this didn't happen by accident. He wasn't sleep driving.
Yeah, I mean, he wasn't just, you know, having uncontrollable craving for a fresh bacon sandwich.
Yeah, I mean, you know, he wasn't possessed by aliens at the time, or, you know, something didn't step into his body and make him do it unconsciously. I mean,
we can't confirm or deny that.
Well, yeah, exactly. I mean, if you listen to the way it carries on TV, you'd have to wonder. But, I mean, I think economics is only useful as a form of employment for economists, quite frankly. But so here's these commonalities, and then we have Quarter Mentha is commissioned to write the report damning Alan Hubbard, and that report has been used ever since, right? So they initially said $300 million worth of toxic related party loans where the people, if we've got no way of knowing whether these people were paying their loans back or not. We've only got Quarter Mentha's word for it and the government's word for it. We can't actually get the proof anymore, right? Because no trial's ever been had. Right? So none of the stuff's ever appeared in a courtroom. We've only got their word for it. Bernard Hickey assists the process by really sticking it to Alan Hubbard with his 10 reasons why Alan Hubbard should apologise to New Zealand article, right? Now, this is long before Alan Hubbard was ever even charged with a crime, right? So you've got all these heavyweight hitters like John Key and, you know, Bernard Hickey and all these guys wading into it, sticking it furiously to Alan Hubbard long before the man's ever even charged with a crime. Right, and nobody is questioning the failure in process here. And on top of all of that, quietly in the background, they're all working off of Quarter Mentha's report. Next minute, South Canterbury Finance goes under, and all of Alan Hubbard's investments in dairy holdings get put on the block. Right, by who other than the Crown? And how much are we talking about? 45,000 hectares. 45,000 hectares of prime South Island dairy farming land. So all of these same players involved in both of these situations, and people aren't connecting the dots. What do we have? Let's cut down to the basic facts. Now, anyone who hates Alan Hubbard, hates me, hates anyone defending Alan Hubbard, loves John Key, doesn't want any of this stuff questioned, has to. The one thing none of these people can argue with are the facts, the historical facts. What I'm saying here are not my opinion. They're facts. What are the facts? Bernard Hickey, a key protagonist against Alan Crafer and Alan Hubbard in both situations. Corda Mentha, directly involved in both situations, South Canterbury Finance and Crafer Farms. Both Alan Hubbard and Alan Crafer lost their businesses, their empires, whatever you want to call it, on the basis of accusations alone. Both cases, no court orders were used. Both cases, both men were hanged by the media, in the media, by media trials without any access to a courtroom, no opportunity to defend themselves. All these decisions were made regardless of them, right? So you have a situation where the next situation, the next fact is who became the principal, I guess, vendor of the land in both situations? The Crown. So what do we have? Two citizens of New Zealand. Let's understand this clearly. Two citizens of New Zealand have had their assets seized and sold by the Crown on the basis of accusations alone, with no court orders, no trials, right? After yes, they did have a trial, but it was conducted in the media, by the media. The evidence was all rhetoric. No proof has ever been provided, right? I mean, there was no context ever given for the animal welfare issue in Alan Crafer's case. It was all done on the basis of the whole thing occurred on the back of the wave of public outrage about these pigs. Right? That's the whole receivership occurred as a result of the wave of public outrage about these pigs, which again was sparked by Bernard Hickey, one of the key players in both situations. Now, you'd have to wonder who is putting Bernard Hickey up to stick it to all these people.
If you ever look at his YouTube channel, he's got 1,000 subscribers. I've got nearly 6,000 subscribers, and his average views on his videos are between 60 and 200. I've got videos that have like 40,000 and what have you. I'm not even making any money off that YouTube channel. Where the hell's his money coming from?
I personally don't understand why anybody would listen to Bernard Hickey, but, you know, that's their choice. But the thing is that these commonalities between these two issues are facts, and what I'm saying are facts, and that is that whatever way you look at it, you can argue about it till you're blue in the face, oh, these guys were guilty, the rest of it, doesn't change the fact that these men lost everything on the basis of accusations alone, and whatever way you look at it, the Crown became the vendor of their property, of their land, right, on the basis of accusations alone, with no court orders and no trials. So even drug dealers, convicted drug dealers, got better protection than these two men did.
What other sources of alternative media or things of that nature have been waffling on about this as well? Because that was another reason why you wanted to come on. No, I'm not talking about defending them. I'm talking about attacking them.
You're the only person that's provided any vehicle by which Alan Hubbard could have got a defence. Nobody else in the mainstream has been bothered. And I'll tell you what I'm disappointed about. Is the actions of people like Martin Bradbury, right? What Martin Bradbury did after Alan Hubbard died, which was completely and utterly gutless after Alan was killed, was to write that article calling him Mr. Magoo. Very disrespectful, unbelievably disrespectful, actually really hurtful for the people who knew Alan, right? Calling him Mr. Magoo and calling him a fraud. I mean, it didn't take a lot of guts to do that. after the guy was dead. I mean, at least the other journalists were sort of sticking it to him when he was alive, knowing full well that he wouldn't fight back. So they all got, you know, everybody was really brave, you know, really sticking it to this 83-year-old guy on dialysis, you know, hey, New Zealand, I'm your champion. I'm sticking it to this old guy for you because he's that bad that you need me to help you protect you from him. You know what I mean? I mean, what a bunch of tossers, right? But at least they did it when he was alive. He could have sued him. I used to say to him, mate, sue this guy, sue that guy. And he actually thought about it. He thought about suing Bernard Hickey. He actually came close to it. He was advised to because what Bernard did was just shocking. But at least it was done when Alan was alive. The worst aspect about what Bradbury did was that Bradbury was just a flea. That man is a flea. He waited until Alan was dead and then he sort of sneaked out and stuck it to him, you know. And it was just pathetic. I mean, he didn't provide any facts to support anything he said. He basically just, it was all rhetoric and spin. And I'll tell you why he did it. Listen up, New Zealanders, and you listen up, you Labour supporters, right? Labour does not want this issue gone over. Labour doesn't want this issue delved into just as much as National doesn't want it delved into. And I'll tell you the reason why. Because 62 finance companies collapsed on their watch. And they know it. And they know they can't kick up a stink about the travesty of justice involved here. They sort of danced around it a bit by asking a few questions in Parliament when they thought they might stand a chance of making John Key look bad on the procedural issues. But overall, Labour decided to leave it alone. It's all a big, hairy, scary issue because they know damn well that they could easily be criticised by a lot of people for the fact that most other finance companies collapsed on their watch with little or no regulatory oversight. Now, in my opinion, Martin Bradbury is very cunningly and cleverly trying to help Labour rewrite history by putting a spin on the situation to sort of help National in a roundabout way continue making Alan Hubbard look like he's to blame for it all, because it actually suits Labour to not have this tin of worms opened up. Because all that's going to happen is it's going to end up in a big shit fight that no one will win because John Key will just stand up in Parliament and, excuse my French, sorry,
it's going to apologise to the affiliates as well.
Yeah. It's going to end up in a fight that no one can win because they know very well that National can stand up in court in Parliament and wipe the floor with them over their failure to act on the other finance company. And that is the reason why, in my opinion, Martin Bradbury has been busily sticking it to Alan Hubbard without any evidence and without any facts. He's just continuing the spin, continuing the rhetoric, continuing to try to influence public opinion that this man was a fraud, and he's actually helping Labour in the process. David Cunliffe doesn't want this tin of worms opened up because it makes him look bad. Do you understand that? And he knows that National can wipe the floor with him because all of those finance company collapses happened on his watch and he didn't act.
Was David Cunliffe the finance minister or something like that under Labour?
Associate finance minister.
Okay.
Now, you know, so nobody's in. The thing that upsets me about this is that nobody has shown any interest in the procedural issues here. And the thing that really concerns me about the future of this country and the future of our society is that the core issue that people have turned a blind eye to here is very simple. I've said it before. You, New Zealanders, every single one of you is entitled to the presumption of innocence before being proven guilty in a court of law, proper court of law, before your peers. Alan Hubbard has been denied that right. Now, you can argue about this until you're blue in the face about whether you think that man was guilty based on what John Key and everyone else has said, but that doesn't change the fact that he never had a trial. So if you are demanding that everybody accept that Alan Hubbard was guilty, regardless of the fact, then you are basically saying that in this particular case, because the amount of money is involved, we should dispense with this person's rights. And I'm saying no. If you start doing that, no matter how little or how much money is involved, you are breaking and weakening one of the fundamental cornerstones of a civil and compassionate society. You deny one other member of society that right, you deny everyone that right. If you deny one person that right, you undermine that right for everybody. That is the basis on which I defended Alan Hubbard.
I've been saying that unless we're all free, none of us are free.
Absolutely. You know, you if you stand by and turn a blind eye to the stripping of one person's rights, regardless of what the reasons are, right, then you are undermining everybody's rights. And I said to you in my last interview, listen up, New Zealand. You cannot have the situation in a civil society where one person like John Key can stand up and issue an accusation and half the country believes that the person he's accusing should have their rights dispensed with because of the amount of money involved or whatever the justification is given. You cannot have that. The second you allow that to happen, you're on a slippery slope where all of our rights are becoming eroded. And the only difference between Alan Hubbard and Kim.com is the fact that Kim.com has a retaliatory nature and he's prepared to stand up for himself. Alan Hubbard was so naive. Alan Hubbard was such a nice guy that he just couldn't bring himself to believe that anyone could be as evil as we were telling him they were. And he just was convinced that there was some way to resolve all of this, that if he worked quietly, if he trusted his lawyers, which he began not to do towards the end, but that he just kept agreeing with everything his lawyers said, that his lawyers would help him find a way to negotiate a peaceful resolution to this with the government. We were just tearing our hair out with Alan in the end. I think the biggest mistake that he ever made was trusting his lawyers, because in my opinion, they have fundamentally failed in their duty to care for their client, and I accuse them directly of that, and they can challenge me on it, but I'll guarantee they'll never ever drag me into a courtroom to attack me for it, because they know I can prove I'm right.
Now, I believed as soon as I heard that Alan Hubbard had died in a car crash, I was highly suspicious of that. You know, how convenient for the government, all of a sudden this whole thing goes away.
It was an accident.
Yeah.
Ask me.
Yeah. Was it an accident, you reckon?
No way. Not in a million years. Not with what I know. No way with that. And I'll tell you why, because I know specific facts related. I knew Alan and Jean so well in the end. She still calls me, right? She still calls me and stays in touch with me long after he died. She's quite lonely now, sadly. But I even knew what they were going to be doing the day after he was killed. If anybody wants to verify this, they can go away and check if they like, as it's absolutely correct. The day after Alan Hubbard was killed, he was due to fly to Nelson with his wife at his one of his daughter's request, because one of his daughters is the accountant for Helicopters New Zealand, which, if you remember, was one of the companies that he tipped into. Here's the thing. He tipped Helicopters New Zealand and Scales Corporation into South Canterbury Finance as an act of good faith to the New Zealand taxpayers after the government applied the Crown Guarantee. He was the only finance company owner in the world, to act in good faith in that manner, to put his own private assets into the company after the Crown Guarantee, the government guarantee, was applied, as an act of good faith to say to people, I'm giving you this as a gift just to show you that I'm acting in good faith. And nobody, that was never ever used in his defence in the media trial against him.
And unfortunately, we've come to break. Let's get back into this, because I called this sort of expose the Alan Hubbard conspiracy, because when two or more people come and they attack another person without people knowing why or how, that's qualified as a conspiracy, ladies and gentlemen, okay? Because somebody's benefiting. We'll be right back with Paul Carruthers.
Ladies and gentlemen, do me a favor, smash the television and burn the newspaper. That shit will never tell you that the president's a traitor.
Believe what you want. My evidence is greater. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show. On AmericanFreedomRadio.com, and incidentally, the VinnieEastwoodShow.com. You do realize, folks, that we're on 5 days a week, right, and all of it's archived, and if you want some commercial-free archives, oh boy, do you just go and give me a donation or subscribe for as little as $1 a month, and we will get you the link to the ad-free archives page, baby. Saves you so much listening time, and it's actually really, really awesome, because the conversation just goes right up. You know, it's the fastest 2 hours in talk radio, and when it's ad-free, it's like the fastest hour and 35 minutes in talk radio. It's unbelievable. And Paul, I don't know if you'll be offended by this, but incidentally, you know, I wasn't even thinking about it. I was like, what's the first shirt or something that's off the line that I can just wear today? And it was this one. It says, I support gay marriage, so long as both chicks are hot.
Mate, let me tell you something about gay people. Gay men should not get married. They should just find someone they hate and buy them a house.
And I cut out the middleman.
Anyway, let's not go there. Where were we?
We're talking about how Alan's car crash.
Okay, yeah. Look, I know Alan's doctor quite well because I got to know him. He was one of Alan's investors. Lost a lot of money in it, actually, but refused to let that influence him. Look, here's the thing. People need to ask themselves this. Why did we have the situation where there were people Alan Hubbard knew personally who lost more than $1 million because of the government's actions, but who refused to allow that to influence them and who stood by him rigidly and still do to this day? Why did they do that? Why would they do that if they didn't know beyond any doubt that this man did not deserve what was done to him? Why would they do that? How could a person lose more than $1 million and yet still say, bugger that, I don't care about that, this guy's innocent? Why would they do that? They are the people that the public should be listening to, not all the people who never met Alan Hubbard. Here's the thing, Bernard Hickey stuck it to Alan Hubbard, never met him, never spoke to him. Martin Bradbury stuck it to Alan Hubbard. Never met him. Never spoke to him. Who do these people think they are? What gives them the sense of entitlement that says they can destroy the life of a fellow New Zealander, just destroy their reputation, destroy their dignity, strip them of everything with their rhetoric and their articles, and they don't even bother phoning the guy up and asking him his point of view? Mate, that's not journalism. At best, it's cowardice. At best, it's pure cowardice. At worst, it's Machiavellian.
I think at worst it's scumbaggery.
It's just pure scumbaggery. And Bradbury is simply helping Labor rewrite history and sweep this under the carpet, mate, with all this rhetoric. And I'm actually intensely angry with him for it, because I'll tell you the reason why I'm so angry with Martin Bradbury, even more than I'm angry with the likes of
Hickey and whatever.
All those guys. It's because of all people, he should know better. This guy holds himself out to be a social justice campaigner, and yet what he's effectively said with his article is, it doesn't matter if we dispense with Alan Hubbard's rights in this case because of the amount of money involved. Well, how can you be a social justice campaigner if you say, well, okay, above this dollar value, we don't give a shit about people? That's just... Sorry. Okay. The thing is that... You understand the point I'm trying to make?
Oh, yeah.
You can't have the situation where you can't have those kind of double standards playing out and hold yourself out to be a social justice campaigner. Bradbury needs to be more consistent in his approach on that, and I'll call him out on it. I'd forgive the guy if I saw him apologise for him. What he did was completely wrong and indefensible, given that the man was dead. He never had a trial. You can't stick it to a dead man who never had a trial. It's just wrong. By anybody's standards, right? So that's my gripe with Martin Bradbury. And move on from that. Alan Hubbard's death, here's the facts that people should understand. The other driver came onto their side of the road. And the police have told Jean Hubbard, now this came from her own words to me in person, the police have told her that she was stopped at the time of impact. At the point of impact, she had already stopped. She was stopped in her lane heading south. The other guy had crossed over, had come towards them in their lane for quite some considerable distance, to the point where she saw him coming and braked and stopped. This guy hit them at over 100 kilometres. He started braking 10 metres before the impact. He hit... Bearing in mind they're in the southbound lane, Alan Hubbard's in the passenger seat, so he's on the left-hand side of the car, right? The other guy's coming northbound in the southbound lane on their side of the road and still hits Alan Hubbard's side of the car. So he would have been heading towards the grass verge or the ditch, right? This guy braked 10 metres before he hit them at full speed, because the skid marks are 10 metres or about 10 metres long, and he hit them at whatever speed you're still doing when you brake at 100 kilometres an hour. You skid for 10 metres, whatever speed you're still doing, he hit them at that speed and took out Alan Hubbard's side of the car, right? Now, they were all taken to hospital in Oamaru. Alan Hubbard survived for nearly... Alan Hubbard was alive for nearly 2 hours in the Oamaru emergency department, laughing and chatting with the nursing staff. He had been stabilised. He had a broken femur, that's a leg bone, a thigh bone. He had a fractured pelvis and a broken hip, by my understanding. His injuries were survivable. He had been stabilised. He was known to have been, there's a newspaper article that actually says from a witness was there at the time and said he was laughing and joking with nursing staff in the Oamaru emergency department before he was airlifted by helicopter to Dunedin Hospital. Now, that flight was about 20 minutes long. He died in that helicopter. Alan Hubbard was not killed in a car accident. Alan Hubbard died while being transferred from Oamaru Hospital, where he left. He was alive when he left Oamaru Hospital. He was dead when he arrived in Dunedin 20 minutes later. Alan Hubbard died in the ambulance as a result of what? We don't know.
There was no autopsy?
Why? Now, here's this. There is an autopsy report, but it's been suppressed. 3 days after he died, that support was... the government sought to suppress Alan Hubbard's autopsy report, and that has occurred. Now, I know Alan Hubbard's doctor personally, their surgeon, right? He has read the autopsy report, and this is his exact words to me. He said the family are not educated enough to understand what the implications contained in this report are. He said, but I am not satisfied with the autopsy report. He said, and this is his exact words to me, he said the type of tests they ran on Alan's body were not the type of tests that would normally be run on a road accident victim. He said, I'm not satisfied with the autopsy report. He said, it's inconclusive. And he said, it suggests to me that they were either deliberately or accidentally looking for the wrong things. Okay? So that's from his doctor. Okay? Now, you know, I don't know whether he was given a blood transfusion in the helicopter or not, but what I do know, again, from the same doctor, is that John Key apparently had Dunedin Hospital put under lockdown when that helicopter arrived and the announcement made that Alan Hubbard was dead. That night, the Friday night, John Key had the whole of Dunedin Hospital put under lockdown. Now, why was that the case? Why did the Prime Minister, if that is true, and I don't know if it was, but if it was true, why was the Prime Minister interfering in that matter? What possessed John Key to interfere in that matter? All right, for a start, people should be asking these kind of questions. Secondly, why has the autopsy report been suppressed? Why? Why can't we see it? Right? Thirdly, why has the other driver... We're now in what? Where are we? March 2013. The accident occurred in September 2011. The other driver still hasn't gone to trial yet. He was allowed to walk into court three times last year in 2012 and seek an adjournment of his trial and was granted it. No questions asked. How did that happen? How has this guy got away without actually ever going to trial? And more importantly, when he was on their side of the road and hit them head on, how does he get away with pleading not guilty? I mean, he's entitled to, but how can he plead, realistically, not guilty? I mean, what planet does this guy live on? He was on their side of the road. It's just, this whole thing's disturbing. And here's another factor that a lot of people don't realise. 3 days after Alan Hubbard was killed, right, and I use that term very carefully, he wasn't killed in a car accident, but I still say he was killed on that day, right? 3 days after Alan Hubbard was killed, his court case that he was taking against the government to challenge their actions against him, much in the same way Kim.com has, was due to start. Alan Hubbard's case against the government that he took to challenge their actions against him was due to start 3 days after that accident on the day he was killed.
Mm. And this accident also happened on a straight road.
straight piece of road. It goes for 2 kilometres, dead straight. Now, I know the evidence because I was on the phone with Alan the night before he was killed. That's why I know that on the day after he was killed, he was due to fly to Nelson. What had happened was the day after he was killed, him and Gene were due to fly to Nelson to attend the ceremony, a ceremony where Helicopters New Zealand was being handed to the new Canadian owners, the Canadian helicopter company that bought it. They had requested that Alan Hubbard come to that handover ceremony out of respect for the fact that he had built that company, that he pioneered the rescue helicopter service in New Zealand, that he pioneered the helicopter industry in New Zealand. They wanted to show recognition for that by inviting Alan and Gene to Nelson. So I know for a fact they were due to fly to Nelson to be with their daughter to attend the handover ceremony of this company that he had effectively given away to the New Zealand public, right, as part of the South Canterbury Finance thing, which he was never acknowledged for. Now, that was due to happen the day after he died. So this is how much I know. And I was on the phone with Alan the night before he died. He was telling me in the 2 weeks before that case was due to start, he'd started to tell me what evidence was going to be put in the courtroom. So I know how incriminating it was going to be for John Key. I was rubbing my hands together and waiting for it, bearing in mind this was 5 weeks before the election. Right? So what would have happened if Alan Hubbard had survived and gone to court and tabled the documents that his lawyers had against the government, questioning the government's actions against Alan Hubbard? What would have happened if the evidence that Alan Hubbard had against John Key and the government was going to be tabled in court? Because I'll tell you what the first piece of evidence was going to be. Alan Hubbard's lawyers were going to walk into court 3 days after he was killed and they were going to put down the videotape of John Key on the steps of Parliament influencing public opinion against Alan Hubbard while the matter was still under investigation. That was one of the first pieces of evidence that was going to be used against the government because it was indefensible. John Key cannot now, unlike Kim.com, where he's got the protection of saying, I was advised, my officials didn't tell me this and I only saw a photograph on an iPad somewhere briefly, right? He's got plausible deniability. He had no plausible deniability in Alan Hubbard's case because there he is on the steps of Parliament on national television, flat out influencing public opinion on the issue. So the Prime Minister has perverted the course of justice and nobody's questioned it. That was going to be questioned in the court case that was due to start 3 days after Alan Hubbard was killed. And John Key would have had to answer for that, and that was 5 weeks before the election. Now, how the hell was John Key going to wriggle out of that situation? And more importantly, why haven't the media questioned it? Why did nobody in the media provide a conscience on that issue and go out with an article saying, why is the Prime Minister influencing public opinion on an issue that's still under investigation? How is this happening?
I can offer one answer for that. I did interview a mainstream media journalist from Fairfax Media, and he said, I refuse to ask really tough questions of these big politicians that I interview, because if I start asking tough questions, I'll never be accepted for an interview again.
Right? So here's the thing. What John Key did was utterly legally indefensible. There is no way that Alan Hubbard could easily have argued that the Prime Minister not only perverted the course of justice, but effectively cost the government the Crown's case against Alan Hubbard by influencing public opinion on the matter while it was still under investigation. That evidence alone could have had the case thrown out. So here you had the government. You think about this, New Zealand. Here you've had the government had created this huge media trial against this man, all orchestrated, where more than half of New Zealand was, if not convinced, then certainly wondering whether Alan Hubbard was guilty or not, based on what John Key and all of his mates and all the media people and all the rhetoric had said, right? What if John Key had been caught pants down, red-handed, 5 weeks before the election, in a situation he couldn't wriggle out of, where there was this court case that he could not argue that he hadn't influenced public opinion on this issue? Because there it is in black and white. There it is in the TVNZ archives. The evidence is incontrovertible. He did that. He can't distance himself from it. Now, that You that was absolute flat-out perversion of the course of justice at the Prime Minister's own hands. He cannot get out of it. That could have easily cost the case, the Crown, the case against Alan Hubbard, and should have.
And not to mention lost the election.
Let me put it to you this way. If you were Alan Hubbard's lawyer, the first thing you would have done is walked into court and said, Your Honour, the Crown...
Oh, sorry, Paul, we've got to break now. We'll hold that thought. We'll be right back, ladies and gentlemen. Paul Carruthers from New Zealand investigating the instances around Alan Hubbard. You know, ladies and gentlemen, I bet you've never heard any of this before. Okay, you know why? It's been freaking covered up, and we're uncovering it today. We'll be right back. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. Final segment here with Paul Carruthers. All right, so we wanted to finish off discussion about the suspicious circumstances surrounding Alan's death and, of course, any final closing statements as well. Paul, take it away.
Well, you know, I mean, we've covered a lot. I mean, at the end of the day, where we were up to when we closed off was the issue of the fact, the proximity of the court case that Alan was taking against the government to his death, or the proximity of his death to the court case he was taking. Now, the point is that the evidence that was going to be tabled in that court case would have found its way into the media very quickly, clearly, because it had been a very high-profile issue. It was 5 weeks before the election, and the evidence that was going to be tabled in court in Alan Hubbard's defence was extremely damaging for the government. Extremely damaging. Alan told me, I don't know if this is true or not, I've done an Official Information Act request and they've come back and played all secret squirrel, so I don't know if this part is true or not. They've said, oh, no such email exists, or we've got no record of that or anything. But Alan told me 2 weeks before he died that his lawyers, because when you're charged with a crime by the Crown, you're entitled to apply for the evidence they've got against you, right? Your lawyer can apply to the Crown for the evidence they've got against you, and they have to give it to you so you can prepare your defence. They received an email from Simon. Now, Alan told me himself that his lawyers were in possession of an email from Simon Power to Treasury that was dated and timed less than an hour before the decision, before Simon Power announced to the whole of New Zealand that Alan was being placed into statutory management and investigated for fraud. Alan told me on the telephone 2 weeks before he died that one of the pieces of evidence his lawyers were intending to use in that court case that was due to start just after he was killed was an email from Simon Power to Treasury, timed less than an hour before the announcement was made by Simon Power on national television on June 20th, 2010, that said something to the effect of, well, Alan's words were that the email said, can somebody please contact me and tell me what statutory management means so I know what I'm talking about. Now, this is from a Minister of the Crown who issued the order to do this to Alan Hubbard and I can produce you dozens and dozens and dozens of emails from Alan Hubbard's investors that were sent after the fact to Simon Power's office saying, why have you done this? This is disgusting. Simon Power, in every single case, replied back and said, and every single reply said, I gave this matter careful consideration.
Now, this is he was the Justice Minister, wasn't he?
Justice who resigned at the last election.
And then he became the head of Westpac Bank, which does the government's banking.
He became the head of Westpac Private Banking, and they were one of the principal beneficiaries of the South Canterbury Finance Receivership. So the conflict, this situation is so riddled with conflicts, it's unbelievable. And New Zealanders need to get this. The only reason that John Key and everyone else involved in this has got away with it is because all of you are so mesmerised by the issue of finance companies and finance company directors. They're all so evil as far as you're concerned that you're happy to dispense with procedure, proper process and justice if in any of these people cases, as long as you're seeing the government hang them. And that is your fundamental mistake. You have effectively, by sitting there in silence and letting this happen, you have assisted John Key and his mates to rip you off. And look, I'll say this for the record now. Nothing would give me greater pleasure than to be proven beyond any doubt that everything I've harped on about for the last 2 years is wrong. Nothing would give me greater pleasure than to be wrong about John Key. But all of the evidence I've seen, and I've been more involved in this than anyone else, right? I've been involved in this as much as Alan Hubbard's lawyers have. I can tell you now, there is no doubt, based on the evidence I've seen, in my mind, that this has been a travesty of justice and that the New Zealand public have been defrauded and that they have not been defrauded by Alan Hubbard. They have been defrauded by everyone from John Key downwards in this situation who's been involved in it. Absolutely no doubt in my mind. And I'm more than happy to be proven wrong. But none of my critics have yet produced any evidence to suggest to prove me wrong. None. What they do is they make it all about my personality or I got angry or I'm all these reasons why no one should listen to me. But none of them ever actually argue with me on the issue. They attack my personality. But they never argue the point. And the reason why? Because they can't. Because the government's actions have been indefensible. Completely indefensible. None of it would stand up in a court of law, and it wouldn't have stood up in a court of law if Alan Hubbard had been allowed to go to court and actually proceed with the case against John Key and the government. But the fact that he was killed 3 days before he got the chance means that we've all got to take John Key's word for it. And, you know, his lawyers are sitting on all the information. I mean, they're still sending his wife bills, $5 million down the track. His lawyers have never issued one word in their client's defence. Not one. They've never issued. They allowed this entire media trial to play out, and not once did they do anything to stem it, stop it from happening, or challenge any of the people. Now, they can take a passive approach and say, well, Alan Hubbard never instructed us to sue them. Well, maybe so, but they still allowed this complete media trial to play out, the complete destruction of their client's reputation, livelihood, businesses, assets, everything, the total destruction. They let it all happen. And not once did they issue any statement in their client's defence or take any action that was designed to stop it.
If I may, is the only thing they've issued more bills for their fees for work they haven't done?
Absolutely. I was saying to Alan long before he was even killed, get rid of your lawyers. He was certainly considering it. But he got to the point where the thing was so complex and entrenched by that stage, he was worried that if he did that, it would make him look guilty. So it ended up in an impossible situation for the guy. Just impossible. Just impossible. And now we find out that the two lawyers that were appointed to defend him, Tim Clark was defending him on the statutory management issue and Michael Heron was defending him on the fraud issue. Tim Clark's been proven in that list that Lockwood Smith, the former speaker of the top 15 people with most influence of Parliament, Tim Clark's number two on the list. And at the end of last year, we see a little newspaper article, Mike Heron's accepted the job of Solicitor General. So the government sticks it to Alan Hubbard and then they offer a job to one of his lawyers after the guy's dead, where they've appointed him as Solicitor General. So the guy's never going to give any evidence against. The guy's got the evidence to prove that what they did to Alan Hubbard was unlawful, and he's now working for Alan Hubbard's accusers. So Alan Hubbard just doesn't stand a chance. And yet, in the middle of all of this, while this was carrying on, a girl leaves her job with the Ministry of Economic Development and the National Enforcement Unit. She leaves her job. She's so distressed by what she's seeing happening that she goes to Alan Hubbard's house and offers to do an investigation for him. This woman worked for the British Securities Exchange Commission. She's arrested people on international arrest warrants for money laundering. She's a private investigator. She's highly qualified. She was a police person. She was a policewoman in New Zealand for 8 years. Very qualified woman. She was so distressed by what the government was doing. She quit her job and she voluntarily wrote Alan Hubbard a report of the government's actions that proved beyond any doubt that the government's actions were unlawful in Alan Hubbard's case, and his lawyers dismissed it.
You know what? It sounds like a massive, massive bunch of criminals saw a massive juicy pot and an easy target. I mean, it's like, look at this. You see a bank that doesn't have a vault, a huge quantity of money inside there, and you are friends with the guards, you're friends with the bank tellers, you're friends with the people who watch all the security videos, and you think, you know what? There's nothing to stop us. Let's just steal it.
My closing statement, Vinny, New Zealand, you have been absolutely had and not by Alan Hubbard, right? And if you don't question this, then you deserve to lose the $1.5 billion that you've just been ripped off for. But if any one of you ever tries to tell me that it was Alan Hubbard's fault, you better know your facts, because I'll walk all over you with them.
And they are, and they also, I wanted to add to that as well, if you let this happen to Alan Hubbard, ladies and gentlemen of New Zealand, it can happen to you, it can happen to anybody.
That's my point all along.
Mm-hmm. Who are you going to trust? If the people that you are elected to protect your rights and your country are in fact the ones destroying your rights and destroying your country.
You are being had. You are being taken for a ride and you're all falling for it. Question this. Question it. Question what happened to Alan Hubbard. Demand answers. And you watch this government run out of corners to hide in 10 seconds flat. Demand an inquiry into what happened here and watch the excuses come out. That should be all the proof you need that I'm right.
Yeah. It's an overarching extra episode of Ghostbusters. Who are you going to call?
All right, mate. Been good talking to you, Vinny.
It has been. All right. Well, we've discussed pretty much everything we can. If you're not willing to listen to this, it's already too late for you, I'm afraid. And if you're not willing to do the right thing, heaven help you. I feel very angry. I feel betrayed. And the fact that I'm the only one in this whole freaking country of 4 million people to give somebody like Paul a platform to tell the truth and the whole truth about this situation doesn't make me proud that I'm the only one doing it. It makes me ashamed that I'm the only one doing it. Ashamed of my country. Ashamed of my people. What's your excuse? What's your excuse? You know? What are you people thinking and playing at? You think this is a good thing? You think that trialing people with no evidence doctored is a free and open and honest society that isn't going to somehow collapse into a massive tyranny where the scumbaggery individuals that rule the country currently ain't just going to get worse and worse and worse and do whatever they want with any of us for no frickin' reason just because they want to steal something from you? What do you think this is going to lead to, ladies and gentlemen? Get off your ass. Do something. Get angry. And don't take no for an answer. I'm Vinny Eastwood, Mr. News, and this has been Paul Carruthers as well. Thank you very much for your attention, ladies and gentlemen. Sorry for getting angry. Hopefully they'll demonize my character and say that, oh, he's a bad person, you know, for that. You know, maybe he'll get some, yeah. All right. We'll see you again sometime, ladies and gentlemen. Don't you go changing that channel.